At this hour, George Allen, the Republican incumbent senator from Virginia, is expected to announce that he is conceding defeat to Democrat Jim Webb. If he does do that, we'll bring you an update later in the program. And if he does do that, of course, it would switch control of the United States Senate to the Democratic Party. Our main focus this hour is on the various ballot measures voters approved and rejected on Tuesday. Exit polls indicated that national issues played a bigger role than usual in midterm elections. Voters did cite the economy, terrorism, and the war in Iraq. And in many states, ballot measures influenced turnout and maybe results. Over 200 propositions made it onto ballots this year. Issues included eminent domain and gay marriage, dove hunting, and pregnant pigs. And the steady increase in the number of ballot measures seems likely to continue in future election years as both parties employ propositions, referenda, and initiatives as tactics to motivate their supporters to come out and vote. The minimum wage and stem cells on the Democratic side, abortion and gay marriage for Republicans. We'll take a look at what passed and what didn't and why, and find out how ballot measures are changing the way elections work. Later in the program, we'll remember the great broadcaster Ed Bradley, who died today of leukemia. But first, local ballot measures. We'd like to hear from you. What was on the ballot where you live? Did it drive you to or turn you from the polls? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And we begin with Fred Solop. He's director of the Social Research Laboratory at Northern Arizona University. And he joins us now from the studios of our member station KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. And it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Let's talk about immigration-related measures, which were on the ballot there in Arizona. Many months ago, immigration was erroneously projected to be a hot-button issue across the country, but in Arizona, it sure was.
Absolutely. We had four immigration-related issues on our ballot, and they were put there by the state legislature, and all of them were widely embraced by voters. Almost three-quarters of voters supported each of these proposals.
And which ones passed, and how close was it?
Well, all four passed. We had Proposition 100 was bailable offenses, preventing those charged with serious offenses who are illegal immigrants from being eligible for bail. That passed. We had standing in civil actions, blocking undocumented immigrants from being able to obtain punitive damages and lawsuits, also passed. We had an English as official language proposition on the ballot, also passed. And finally, we had an extension of a previous proposition that passed in the state in 2004, where we're preventing additional government-funded services from being made eligible to illegal immigrants. All of these passed, and they all passed in the 70, 71, 72, 73 percentile range.
Now,
this is a consensus issue in Arizona.
And interestingly, all of these had come up earlier, passed by the legislature there in Arizona. They had all been vetoed by Governor Janet Napolitano. And at the same election, they reelected Janet Napolitano and passed all of these initiatives.
Absolutely. It would seem like a contradiction, but not necessarily if you're a little familiar with Arizona politics. This was an opportunity for the state legislature to come back. They knew that these proposals would be widely supported in the public. They put these on the ballot as well, thinking that this was an opportunity to build opposition to Janet Napolitano's reelection. That did not work. The ballot propositions passed. We find in our polling in the Social Research Lab that Arizonans are very concerned with this issue. This is the most important issue facing Arizona today. Arizonans embrace different solutions, anything from a border security solution to guest worker policy. Arizonans want something to be done. In this situation, we found that the propositions were being supported by Arizonans, but the candidates who were running very strident campaigns largely on immigration issues just were turned back. The voters themselves embraced candidates who spoke to a broader set of issues and a broader set of values. We see that in the governor's race, Janet Napolitano being reelected. We see that in Congressional District 8, which is a border district, which was the center of the immigration debate. The more moderate Democrat won out over the more conservative Republican who used immigration as a single issue.
Let's turn to another big issue that emerged from Arizona's ballot measures, and that is gay marriage. Several states this year, and also, as everybody remembers, back in the 2004 presidential elections, had ballot measures that would create constitutional amendments to ban gay marriage. Arizona voted against that.
That's right. We're the only one in the nation at this point to vote against it. And I just caution to say that it's been vetoed in this state only because there are a significant number of ballots yet to be counted. We understand from the state that there are approximately 260,000 ballots that have yet to be counted. This was a very close initiative, and it's possible that it would actually be supported.
So that that one's still up in the air, and we shouldn't take the question as settled as yet.
It is not settled, but there is a different politics in this state around that issue. The opposition to gay marriage really honed in on the fact that this was a two-part measure, not only defined marriage as the union of a man and a woman, but it also denied partner benefits, domestic partner benefits. And that would affect many people in Maricopa County, the largest county in Arizona, who are receiving or are eligible to receive partner benefits from state government or public universities. It also would affect elderly people, and this was turned away by the voters, largely thinking about these other issues, not solely gay marriage.
Okay. Fred Solop, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Fred Solop, director of the Social Research Laboratory at Northern Arizona University, with us today from the studios of member station KNAU in Flagstaff. John Matsusaka is president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute at the University of Southern California. He's been watching the whole gamut of ballot propositions and results this year and in past elections. And he joins us today from the studios of member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here.
Now, we just discussed gay marriage in Arizona. I think four other states at least had gay marriage amendments on their ballots. How did they turn out?
That's right. There were actually eight states total that had gay marriage amendments on the ballot. Seven of those passed. This is actually an issue that seemed almost bulletproof until the Arizona vote. So far, 23 of these things have been passed, not even by close margins. And Arizona, if it does go down, I didn't realize there were still so many ballots to be counted.
Mm-hmm.
But if it does go down, that would be the first one ever to go down.
And were these mounted? Is this detectable as an effort by conservatives to drive conservative voters to the polls on this and other issues?
That's certainly not the primary motive, and certainly in 2004 that wasn't the primary motive as well. I think after 2004, though, everybody has at least in the back of their mind that this might help Republican candidates.
And similarly, we saw a lot of minimum wage amendments and referenda and initiatives on ballots this year, and they're different in different states. Let's not get into that. But was that a concerted effort, do you think?
Minimum wage definitely was definitely a concerted effort. The groups that promoted that, the progressive groups, are not shy about admitting that. For the first time, which is really interesting about this, for the first time, a group decided to try to use ballot propositions to tilt the balance of power in Washington. And so they put measures on the ballot in six states. A couple of them turned out to be very, very close, Montana and Missouri. So it might have paid off for them.
And did they pass largely?
All of them passed. We kind of knew they were all going to pass because this issue just polls so well. People just like the idea of a minimum wage, and it cuts across all parties, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. Everybody likes minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller in on the line. If you'd like to join us, by the way, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. This is Robin. Robin calling from New York City.
Hi. Thanks for accepting my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment that I've heard a lot of commentary about the gay rights initiative pulling out a lot of conservative voters. I think what's not being considered is from the last election in 2004, all of the numbers show that among the different demographics across the country, African Americans were most strongly opposed to the gay rights initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that if that's the case, then it was probably the African-American vote against the gay rights initiative that caused them not to pass, and those same African-American voters helped the Democrats to be elected across the country.
Is he right on both of those points? Did African-Americans turn out to vote against gay marriage initiatives or against gay marriage, let's put it that way? And if they did, generally speaking, if you're bringing African-Americans to the polls, you're bringing Democrats to the polls.
I think what Robin is saying might sound surprising to a lot of people, but could very well be the truth. We do know that opposition to gay marriage is strongest among the African American community. Now, what it actually did in terms of the actual votes is in dispute. But for 2004, political scientists who have actually sifted through the election returns carefully have come to the conclusion that those measures did not actually help Bush, and if anything, did end up hurting Bush. So Robin could well be right.
Interesting call, Robin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does this suggest, though, that if you're looking at these initiatives, as the parties try to use them tactically to bring their supporters to the polls, that we're going to see another round of this come 2008?
Well, I definitely think we're going to see more, especially the minimum wage measures. We don't exactly know whether they helped or not, but even if you can get a tiny bit of help in a close race, it's really important. So I think everybody is going to start looking at this strategy now.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get Steve on the line. Steve is with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Hi there.
Hi.
I went and voted, and it was not the ballot initiatives that got me to go. I would have voted anyway. But here in Missouri, of course, we had the big stem cell Amendment 2 on the ballot. And the thing that I thought was interesting, and I wonder if you could address it, it may be a subject for a different show, I don't know, but it was polling very strongly to pass before the election, and it passed just barely, like by 51-49 or mm-hmm. closer. And I think it was quite well outside the margin of most of the polls, margin of error of most of the polls. And so, you know, I just wonder, what are the implications of that? People talk about the media skewing their polls to try and influence voter opinion. And, you know, I suppose you could throw that up as a data point.
I'm just going to cut you off here, Steve, because we're running out of time. John Matsusaka, did it end up driving both sides to the polls?
We don't know yet what it did to the side, but I would just add on the polls. It's very common for measures to do really well early and then their support to fall during the campaign. So there's nothing really suspicious about that. That's kind of a standard procedure.
All right, Steve. Thanks very much for the call. We'll talk more about stem cell research when we come back after the break. John Matsusaka, stay with us there in Pasadena, California. And we also have to hope to have for you an update on the status of control of the United States Senate. George Allen is speaking to his supporters in Richmond, Virginia now, and he's expected to be conceding defeat to his Democratic challenger, Jim Webb. I'm Neil Cunningham. We'll be back with more on that after a short break. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our main focus this hour is on various ballot measures voters approved and rejected on Tuesday. But first, an update on two elections to the United States Senate. A couple of hours ago, incumbent Republican Conrad Burns conceded defeat in Montana. Democrat John Tester is senator-elect. And just a few minutes ago, Republican incumbent George Allen made a statement in Virginia. And let's listen to what Mr. Allen had to say.
My friends, sometimes winds, political or otherwise, can blow the leaves off branches and even break limbs. But a deep-rooted tree will stand. Stay standing. It'll regrow in the next season. In this season, the people of Virginia, who I always call the owners of the government, they have spoken. And I respect their decision. The Bible teaches us that there's a time and place for everything. And today, I've called and congratulated Jim Webb and his team for their victory. They had the prevailing winds.
Republican incumbent George Allen conceding there to his Democratic rival, Jim Webb. Here with us in the studio is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. Nice to have you back on the program.
Hi, Neil.
Ken. It seems a program without Ken Rudin is like a program without sunshine.
People have said that.
Senator Allen concedes. That means control of the United States Senate shifts to the Democrats.
That's the big headline. First of all, it's a tremendous come down for Senator Allen, who is looking at a presidential run 2 years from now. But more importantly, right now, it means that the Democrats will have 51 seats in the Senate in the 110th Congress, giving them control that they lost in 1994.
Mm-hmm. And that means, of course, Democrats have both the House and the United States Senate. John Tester earlier today winning, he'd been declared the winner yesterday, I guess, in Montana, but finally a concession from the incumbent senator there.
I mean, people talk about this being an anti-incumbent year. What this really was an anti-Republican incumbent year. They picked up 6 seats in the Senate, at least 28, 29 in the House, perhaps some more, because there are about 8 or 9 still not counted yet, not confirmed yet, with some Republican incumbents trailing. So it's been it was a tough couple of days for the Republican Party, and today they make it official in the Senate.
And just give us a brief outline where those eight or nine seats that are undecided?
Well, Rob Simmons in Connecticut is still fighting for his life. He's trailing in Connecticut. Heather Wilson in New Mexico is up by just a little bit. Robin Hayes, a Republican in North Carolina, up by only 468 votes. Barbara Cuban in Wyoming, a statewide congresswoman in a state where obviously Dick Cheney served in Congress. She's only up by about 800-900 votes. Very, very close there, too. So some Republican incumbents are hanging on for dear life. The biggest headline of the news is that not one single Democratic incumbent, House, Senate, or governor, has been defeated, nor has a Democratic seat gone to the Republican Party.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks,
and obviously, more on all of this later today on from NPR News, and especially on All Things Considered. Ken Rudin with us here in Studio 3A. He's NPR's political editor, and you can read his Political Junkie column at npr.org. Well, let's get back to ballot initiatives. It wasn't just Iraq and corruption that got voters to the polls on Tuesday. In some states, issues like stem cells, affirmative action, and gay marriage appeared on the ballot, boosting Democrats in some places, Republicans in others, and opening the door for greater use of ballot measures as a tool in future elections. Our guest is John Matsusaka, president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute at the University of Southern California. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. What was on the ballot where you live? Did it drive you to the polls or turn you away from them? You can also send us email, talk@npr.org. And John Matsusaka, I did want to ask you, there were, in addition to a lot of these national, we've been talking about stem cells and immigration issues that were on the ballot in Arizona, but the issue that was on the ballot also in a lot of states, and I wonder, was this one way or the other, and that is eminent domain.
Eminent domain was on the ballot in 11 different states. This was a reaction to a Supreme Court ruling, a Kelo ruling earlier in this year, which essentially said that governments are able to use their power of eminent domain to seize private property and turn it over to another private user. And that struck quite a few people as outrageous. And so a number of state legislatures, somewhere about 30 state legislatures on their own, took actions to prevent local governments in their states from doing that. And we saw in another 11 states were voting on it this year, 9 of those passed.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. And this is Samina. Samina calling us from Sonoma in California.
Actually, I'm calling from Santa Clara, but hello.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, thanks very much for the call.
I was actually really surprised about Prop 86 and Prop 87. Prop 87 was, we had people like President Clinton and Al Gore come on and advocate for it. It was basically to raise money to find alternative fuel sources. And given the gas prices in the past few months and how much they've skyrocketed and how much the oil companies have made from the Katrina disaster and, they've had record-breaking, revenues, I was surprised that voters in California voted against it. It was like, I think it lost by 10 points or over 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the surprising propositions that did not pass. And the other one was Prop 86, which was to raise the taxes for cigarettes in order to fund, causes to prevent smoking and youth and also for lung cancer issues. So I was really surprised about why those two propositions did not pass.
John Matsusaka?
Well, Prop 87 especially got quite a bit of attention nationally this year. There was in excess of $150 million spent pro and con on this measure, so that's by far a record. It's not that surprising to me that it passed because it was a very long, complicated measure. And what happens when you write a long, complicated measure is the opponents can find things in it that are questionable. And if you can raise a question in the voter's mind, they'll vote no. In this particular case, the opponents hammered away with the fact that the money was going to be run by some sort of board that was exempted from certain state laws, and they claimed that it would be uncontrolled or unregulated board. And they also raised questions whether putting a tax on oil would actually, in fact, raise the price of gasoline. And I guess it's not clear to me that if you bring in Al Gore and Bill Clinton and Julia Roberts was also involved in pushing for this measure, it's not clear to me that those are the right people to try to allay the fears of California voters that their gas prices might go up.
Mm-hmm. Samina, thanks for the call, and congratulations on getting the San Francisco Giants in your town. I guess she's left us probably to get season tickets. Here's an email we got from Lori in Tempe, Arizona. The Arizona midterm ballot had 19 propositions, more than any other state in the country. At what point does the sheer number of propositions become overwhelming and therefore a disincentive to vote?
Well, that's an interesting question. What we know actually is that the more propositions you have on the ballot, the more people actually go to vote. So they tend to pick and choose. And I guess the thing is, if there's some they're not interested in, they just take a pass on those. They just abstain or they vote no. But you're more likely to get something that will grab people's attention. Hmm. 19 sounds like a lot, but historically it's nowhere close to the record. For example, there was in the earlier part of the 20th century, there was a California ballot that had 48 propositions on it. So if you think 19 is bad, think about 48.
Let's turn now to Michigan, where one proposition against the use of affirmative action in public education, employment, and contracting passed by a wider-than-expected margin. Joining us to discuss it is Earl Ryan, president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, and he joins us from his office in Livonia, Michigan. Nice to have you on the program today.
Good to be here.
What was the margin, and why was it unexpectedly high, do you think?
The margin was 58% in favor and 42% opposed. The suspicions are that polls that were taken prior to the election that showed the proposition very close, pro and con, were done in such a way that the respondents were not necessarily telling the pollsters the true nature of their feeling about the proposal. It is suspected by the pollsters that when issues involve race, you don't always get forthcoming answers from those you are polling.
And it is every indication that Democratic voters came out to the polls there in Michigan. The Democratic governor won re-election in that state. So clearly there were a lot of Democrats voting on this issue against affirmative action.
That's very likely. I haven't seen a partisan breakdown on it. It did not turn out to be a partisan issue because both of the major candidates came on record as opposing Proposal 2.
Now, I understand this has already gone to the courts.
Yes, and there will be other court suits launched. The University of Michigan has already indicated that they will attempt to prevent the proposal from going into effect, which it will do near the end of December under the current Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And this is not the first initiative of its kind. This is, in fact, an extension of an initiative effort that began in the state of California.
That's right. It's a very similar proposal to the one that passed in California in the 90s. And as a matter of fact, it was widely promoted and financed by Ward Connerly, who was the author and champion of that proposal in California.
Now, in a court battle, does the fact that it's been approved by the voters of the state, does that carry more weight than even a bill passed by the legislature?
It certainly does. Courts are very reluctant to set aside votes of the electorate. It can be done, but the courts, for obvious reasons, don't like to tamper with the results of elections.
Mm-hmm. Earl Ryan, thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
Glad to be here.
Earl Ryan, president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, joining us today from his office in Livonia, Michigan. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is, let's go to Ashley. Ashley with us from Manpa, is that right, in Idaho?
Yeah, Manpa, Idaho.
Okay, go ahead, please.
And thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I was calling to say that here in Idaho, one of the most important ballot initiatives we had was the extension of the eminent domain law that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to the NPR coverage on it, and they were talking about how a lot of Idahoans were going out to vote against it, and it wasn't so much that it's the eminent domain, but it was the extension of it, because Idaho already has an eminent domain law that protects private property, and we just didn't want to have this law that allows us to go out and sue if, for some reason, we feel that our property prices have been reduced, like they have in Oregon.
I see. John Matsusaka, was that a refinement which we may have mischaracterized here? I'm not asking you to criticize our coverage. That's up for other people. But is she right about the nature of the ballot measure?
Yes, she is. And what Ashley's referring to is what's called the regulatory takings part of this measure. And it's actually a bit complicated, so it didn't get, in some of the coverages, it didn't get noted. But what happened is the proponents in a couple of states decided to piggyback on top of the eminent domain, the kilo part of these measures, and add this extra part that said any time a government passes a law that reduces the value of someone's property, they have to pay them for it. They added that in Idaho. They also added it in California, and I think that's why both those measures failed.
Mm-hmm. Kilo, of course, is the name of the court case stemming from New London in Connecticut that was decided by the Supreme Court, I think, last year. Ashley, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye. We're talking today about ballot measures and initiatives that voters accepted or rejected on Tuesday, and how the use of these ballot measures and initiatives is changing the way that both political parties are thinking about elections. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is talk@npr.org. And this is Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. One of the most hot-button ballot measures of the year's elections appeared in South Dakota. It was a measure to uphold the state's recent legislation that bans nearly all abortions in that state. The measure failed, 56% voting against, 44% voting for. Joining us to talk about what happened there is Bill Richardson, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of South Dakota. He joins us from his office in Vermilion, South Dakota. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And South Dakota was seen as a place where a stridently conservative abortion law could be tested, and yet here that measure was rejected.
Well, the legislature made a very conservative attempt to pass a law that had really no exceptions whatsoever. No exceptions for rape, no exceptions for incest, no exceptions for the health of the mother.
And this was clearly designed for a test case that should go to the Supreme Court.
That was the clear intention. And, of course, the opponents got a sufficient number of signatures to refer the law to the ballot, where the voters then would have their say, which came to pass last November 7th.
Were the supporters surprised by the rejection by the voters?
Well, I think you began to see in the last month or so that the lack of exceptions was causing a great deal of consternation among voters as we began to visit the various presentations for and against the referred Law 6. And so you have people who may very well have voted for this particular abortion ban had it retained exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
But it made them sufficiently uneasy that the state would have absolutely no potential for protecting a child who was raped. And I think you saw voters sufficiently uneasy, and they voted their conscience on this.
And how did this break down in terms of parts of the state? I mean, was it overwhelmingly rejected as, well, you know, the assumption might be that it would be, the opposition would be in South Dakota cities?
Well, you would expect that you would marshal opposition in large urban areas. But what you saw was a relatively consistent pattern of opposition to the law throughout the whole of the state, in places where in the past you had a very concerted, conservative set of voters who could have been expected to have supported the legislative ban. Perhaps we could look at it this way. If you and I were to craft a law on capital punishment and the law said absolutely no exceptions for anybody who takes the life of another human being, people who may support capital punishment may have been given pause and say, well, I can't support that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have anything to do with intention. There is absolutely no way for an individual who inadvertently caused the death of another to be given some lesser penalty.
So,
I think you saw some of that with the abortion law.
So the explanation that's being bruited about there in South Dakota is that the law was simply too extreme.
And if it came back with the exceptions, you might very well see it pass.
Okay, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And by the way, does this mean it's not going to go to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think right now the law is off the books. So the legislature would have to meet and repass it or pass another version before we can go through this again and see it go to the Supreme Court.
Okay, Bill Richardson, appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
Bill Richardson, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of South Dakota, joining us today from his office in Vermilion, South Dakota. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation on ballot measures that passed and were rejected by voters on Tuesday. We'll be continuing our conversation with John Matsusaka, the president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute at the University of Southern California. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. We're also going to be remembering the great CBS broadcast journalist who died today, and that's Ed Bradley, of course, died of leukemia at a hospital in New York, and we'll be listening to some of his great interviews and his appearance on this program as well. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And right now, we'll continue our conversation about the ballot initiatives that brought voters to the polls on Tuesday. Our guest is John Matsusaka, president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute at the University of Southern California. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Melba. Melba with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I wanted to say about the kind of wedge issue ballot initiatives like gay marriage and abortion.
Yeah.
And I know that in 2004, a lot of African Americans were riled up about them because generally, African Americans tend to be more socially conservative, and they also voted in higher numbers for George Bush just because of the ballot initiatives like gay marriage. But I don't think that's working anymore, and I actually heard people say to me that it's like this, the greatest hits, and they just trot them out every time it's an election, but nothing ever happens about it after the election is over, and they kind of feel like they're being used as a pawn. And then a lot of African-American politicians are making the case that we have bigger things to be concerned about besides gay marriage because that's not impacting us like things like health care and minimum wages are.
Hmm.
And I don't think they'll have the potency, those kind of wedge issues going forward that they used to.
John Matsusaka, what do you think?
Well, I'm not sure they've had much potency in the past, frankly. I think it also has to be kept in mind for most of these issues are not done strategically by the parties to try to generate turnout. The minimum wage this year absolutely for sure was. Most of those marriage amendments in 2004 were just put on there by individuals individuals in the states who were interested in that particular issue. So, I think Melba's correct that it's not clear how important these things really are to driving turnout.
Hmm. Melba, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's an email that we got from Brendan in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm always frustrated by the lack of continuity on vote yes or vote no. Some state abortion propositions resulted in confusion by requiring a no vote to want to keep abortion legal, or was it vote yes? As I'm writing this, I'm already getting confused. Would it be possible to institute some kind of standard to make this easier to understand if you see something on the ballot to vote on that you're not familiar with?
Well, I think the voters figured out in South Dakota what a yes and a no vote means. Of course, each state sets its own rules, and I think each state has its own standards. Some of those can be confusing, but I think in Florida, for example, I think is fairly clear. So I'm not sure that's a big problem in practice.
All right, let's talk with Tim. Tim calling from St. Louis.
Yes, in Missouri, we passed a constitutional amendment to authorize stem cell research, and I was reading in the paper today that in the high 70s, the people that supported Claire McCaskill, and the people that were against it in the low 70s voted for Jim Talent, and as you're probably aware now, Claire McCaskill won. And it looks as though that may have actually played a decisive role, although the original ballot proposition was supported by many Republicans in the state who were very prominent in their support for it, including former Senator John Danforth.
Mm-hmm. So, John Matsusaka, in that case, do you see that it was a pretty close race there for the Senate? This might have made a difference?
Well, it might have made a difference, but what we really don't know. I mean, all we really know is that the people who happen to like Claire McCaskill also happen to like stem cell research and conversely. So we don't yet know whether that somehow brought somebody to the polls, say, who would have sat home, because that's the real critical issue here. Is there somebody who would have sat at home had there not been a stem cell measure on the ballot who actually went to the polls and voted for Claire McCaskill? And that's what we don't know yet exactly. It's going to take some sifting through the data to really figure that out.
And what's your experience on that, Tim? What did people tell you?
Well, I was working at one of the polls, and people were showing up, and they were supporting stem cell and supporting McCaskill. And interestingly enough, Talent took no position on the state minimum wage bill, and McCaskill was very strong in support of it and ran a lot of ads about how he voted against it in the Senate. And that literally may have been the difference in the race, because that initiative passed with over 80% of the vote.
And I'm sure John Matsusaka will say, maybe, let's wait till we sift through the numbers. So anyway,
yeah,
Tim.
I would say the same thing. It's clear Talent was on the wrong side of both those issues, but whether that brought more of his opponents to the poll specifically to defeat him is not yet clear.
But we appreciate the phone call, Tim. Thanks. Let's go now to Cindy, and Cindy calling us from Anchorage in Alaska.
Yes, I'd like to start off by saying that I'm not very educated on this issue because it was hard to get educated on this issue. Up here in Alaska, there's a very big debate up here on the gas line that's trying to be built and taxes and stuff. There is a Proposition 2, to get a tax, I believe, on this issue before it's even built. My whole concern with this issue is that before any of the election stuff was being mailed out, the pamphlets, I already knew from all the money that's being spent by the big businesses to vote no on it. Like, I'm a college student up here, and there is big, like, moving vans being driven around daily with saying, vote no on 2 commercials. Like, I tried to, like, read through pamphlets and read through stuff to figure out what this actually was, and all I could find on the Internet was vote no on 2, vote no. They just seemed to put so much money on this, like the big business did, that it was really intimidating. Like, I think I even went to the vote to say yes on it just because I felt that someone could afford to spend so much money and tell me not to vote it, that I think it might be good. I'm not sure. It did fail. Like, and I think the margin wasn't that big. I just think that it's not getting that much press, this tax, even though it's a huge issue that could really affect all of us up here.
Sure. John Matsusaka?
Yeah, that was a measure 2 in Alaska. That was to put taxes on natural gas leases, a kind of an obscure issue. But I think what Cindy's call points out is one of the truths about ballot propositions is that if people are confused about issues, they don't really quite know what they're about, they tend to vote no. And I think that's one of these issues. It's also one of the things that played into the hands of some of these opponents of these expensive measures in California, where industries were threatened and the industries poured a huge amount of money in to try to raise doubts. And really, all you need to do is raise enough doubts in people's mind. You don't have to convince them it's bad. Just raise enough doubts and they'll vote no. And I think the Alaska case is a good example of that.
Okay.
Cindy, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Bye.
And John Matsusaka, thank you very much for being with us today. We thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
John Matsusaka is president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute at the University of Southern California and joined us today from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Before we leave, an alert listener, Stephen Schmidt in San Rafael, California, noted that I said the San Francisco Giants were moving to Santa Clara. Oops, it's actually the San Francisco 49ers, and he notes that's not even a done deal. So anyway, thank you for that correction, and I apologize for misspeaking. When we come back, we'll remember Ed Bradley.